This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Despite a downward trend, a recent report shows that commercial fishing catch in 2014 was up. This week, I spoke with North Carolina Marine Fisheries Trip Ticket Program Coordinator Alan Bianchi about the latest commercial fishing numbers.
We finalize our commercial fisheries landing statistics, the data for that, in April of each year. Got our landings bulletin and our seafood dealer report created and published in the first week of May.
And what is the importance of that report?
Well, there's two different parts of the report. The fish dealer report is basically a communication from our program to our seafood dealers, and it highlights the trends in our commercial landing over the past 5 or 6 years. And it also just informs our dealers what's going on with our program. Second report is our landings bulletin, and that is just a printout of our commercial landing over the last 5 years.
How have commercial fishing landings increased or decreased over the past decade? Have you noticed any trends?
Yes, the commercial landing over the last decade, the overall trend does show a decline overall. What we saw in the first part of the period from like 2005 to 2009 was that our landings averaged around 62 million to 71 million pounds. And then in 2010, they hit 72 million pounds. But then from that point forward, the landings declined quite a bit. And it went from 72 million down to its lowest point in that period, 2013, where it was only around 50 million pounds.
So how did the 2014 harvest compare with 2013?
Actually, 2014, we saw an increase in our landings compared to 2013, a positive increase there. Our landings actually increased by 23% when compared to 2013. And our total commercial landings were around 50 million pounds. And in 2014, that jumped up to 61 million pounds.
23% sounds like a pretty significant jump. What do you think is the reason for that increase?
We had a number of issues occurring with Oregon Inlet. Larger boats could not actually get through the inlet, especially in our summer flounder fishery and in our fly net fishery. We allowed commercial fishermen to transfer their quota up to Virginia, and they could land up there, which had a dramatic impact on our commercial fishing. So this year, had our commercial fishermen land their summer flounder quota in North Carolina. And also, it looked like that we had good landings in our crab fishery, which also helped quite a bit.
Yeah, and I understand that's one of the more profitable catches, right, blue crabs?
Yes. Over the past 5 years, the two highest-ranking fisheries in terms of excess value is always blue crabs and shrimp. But they're always ranked 1 and 2.
Is that just because they're more plentiful along our coast, or is it that much in demand?
I don't know if I could say it. More plentiful. I think it's just the hard blue crab fishery, I think, is the easy fishery to get into. You can operate it off small boats, crab pots. It's just easy to participate in that fishery. And I think the market for blue crabs, especially when the Chesapeake Bay is having problems, we see our fishery wind up being more productive. There's kind of a number of factors that help with that.
Blue crab and shrimp are more profitable catches for North Carolina. What about finfish? How do they rank?
Our finfish landing, in terms of value, we had $37 million, and the most profitable finfish this past year was our summer flounder. And it just goes to show you how important that one particular species really is to the state.
How much revenue was generated for shellfish? What types of shellfish do we have along the coast?
Okay, shellfish included blue crabs and shrimp, as well as things like oysters and clams and other types of molluscan shellfish. We had around $57 million.
According to the Associated Press, the number of active commercial fishermen in North Carolina has dropped from about 5,000 in 1995 to about 3,000 last year. How has that decrease affected catch?
The number of commercial fishermen has actually remained stable at around 3,200 fishermen over the last 4 years or so. And the overall trend in our landings does show a decline. However, in 2014, we did see that spike.
So it sounds like the 2014 commercial fishing year was either just a fortunate coincidence, or it may be an indication that the industry is actually rebounding.
Yeah, and that's what we're hoping for. Hopefully that trend will continue on. Hope that's a good sign for our fisheries overall. Hope that's a good sign for our production along the coast.
Thanks for your time.
No problem. Bye.
In a nationwide push by the Marine Corps to reduce energy cost and consumption, Camp Lejeune and Cherry Point have begun training troops to cut down on power bills and bad habits. Sarah Finch has more.
Everybody uses electricity in their daily lives, and the U.S. Marines are no exception. Energy is vital for any military base, and energy costs have risen. With annual power bills of $20 million and nearly $40 million respectively, Cherry Point and Camp Lejeune want to cut back. Installation Energy Manager Lieutenant William Peacock, stationed at Camp Lejeune, says the biggest costs come from storing military hardware in North Carolina's temperate environment.
We consume a lot more than MCI West, which is all the bases on the West Coast, and a lot of reasoning behind that is because of how hard our HVAC systems work to get the moisture out of the air, so that takes a lot more energy.
An executive order from President Obama requiring all federal agencies to reduce energy consumption makes conservation at the bases even timelier. The Marine Corps created the Energy Initiative Program to get the ball rolling. Peacock says this program has allowed Camp Lejeune to install cleaner and more efficient systems.
Currently, we're transitioning off centralized steam plants that use coal to more efficient boilers that run off natural gas. You see the PV panels, a lot of people use them for the housing. We have a lot of that here on privatized housing, but we also have, you know, farms where we pump back into the grid.
It also led to the creation of another program, the Unit Energy Managers Program. While the Energy Initiative focuses on broad changes to base infrastructure, the UEM program deals with day-to-day energy habits of individual Marines and units. Cherry Point's Installation Energy Manager Bob Ruffin says the program allows units to smoothly implement strategies that help them the most.
From a facility standpoint, I can only do so much. The base is so large with so many different types of facilities. So the UEMs, they know how their units operate, and they can identify those inefficiencies and without compromising the mission.
So far, the program has been well received. The 42 unit energy managers in training at Cherry Point have actively participated in reducing energy waste, communicating with the rest of their unit. At Camp Lejeune, Lieutenant Peacock says the 100 newly trained UEMs have already started identifying ways in which their units could cut down on inefficiencies.
Maybe sealing up their building a little bit better. Some of them have leaky windows or their ceiling tiles are cracked. Now their HVAC is working harder or pulling more energy to cool or to power. They might run their equipment, their compressors or their generators too long. And, you know, now they're the eyes and the ears. They have that authority to change wasteful behaviors.
Lieutenant Peacock says he hopes the programs will have the same results as the Marine Corps' push to increase on-base safety a decade ago.
You rewind like 10, 12 years ago, and safety was not as big of a deal, you know, Marine Corps-wide, Navy-wide. You look at the progress you've made with a program like safety, which people don't consider it the most important thing. There's other priorities competing, especially in the military. So now safety is a pretty big deal. I believe energy is getting there. That's kind of the idea with the Energy Initiative program that's being rolled out.
Ruffin says the Marine Corps has a duty to be as energy and cost efficient as possible.
There's not an infinite supply of money, and every dollar that we use to heat or cool or light a building is a dollar that can't be used to ensure that our Marines continue to be the best trained fighting force on the planet.
Over the next several months, the UEMs will be communicating the value of energy and providing tips on how to use less power. These efforts may seem small at first, but once integrated into daily operations, can make a real difference. For Public Radio East, I'm Sarah Finch.
Because you appreciate the kind of news reporting that Public Radio East brings you, I hope that you'll take part in helping keep them on the air. Our costs from NPR programs are going up this year, and we can only cover these costs with your contributions. Please give now by making a donation at publicradioeast.org and help PRE raise $60,000 by June 30th. We will keep you posted all through June as we near our deadline. Help give us a great start by making your online donation today at publicradioeast.org. Thank you.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Marie Phillips, mortgage professional with First Citizens Bank in downtown New Bern, specializing in home loans for purchases, refinances, and construction loans. Marie Phillips, 252-637-8222. The North Carolina Symphony is kicking off their summer concert season in eastern North Carolina with a free performance in New Bern at Tryon Palace this Sunday. There's also performances planned for Tarboro on June 4th and in Jacksonville on June 7th. Public Radio East is a media sponsor for these events. Mac McKee caught up with North Carolina Symphony conductor David Glover to talk about the free concerts in your community events happening here in eastern Carolina.
This particular show will be featuring Rossini, Grieg, and Liszt, all prominent Romantic composers. How do you decide the themes of these programs before you do the show?
Well, in the case of this, we wanted to bring just some of the most popular and familiar classical music out to our audiences. So you've got pieces that you recognize from the concert hall, but also from TV shows, from cartoons, from movies. You know, for example, fans of Bugs Bunny, I'm sure, will be familiar with the Barber of Seville and some of the themes from Peer Gynt, like In the Hall of the Mountain King, have really reached pop culture status. You just hear them all over the place in so many different venues.
Are the Romantics the most popular kinds of composers for these more informal summer settings?
Well, I think they're a good choice because they're familiar, but also you know, the Romantics have a big sound to them, so I think they fit the outdoor environment well. You know, they project well, they have a lot of color and diversity within the orchestra, and they're very enjoyable to listen to in the beautiful settings that we're going to be in this week that we're traveling around in eastern North Carolina.
How long has the North Carolina Symphony been performing these summer concerts?
I don't know exactly how long, but it's been years and years that we've been touring around with concerts like this, bringing music all across the state. It's one of our core missions that we have.
Have the performances accomplished not only just an enjoyment of classical music as an art form, but an educational purpose as well, getting your audiences more in tune to maybe things they recognize and maybe some things they thought they might not recognize but do?
I think it's always, you know, fun to go to a concert and you hear something that you know, you've heard the tune before, you've heard it in some other environment, and then you're able to put it in context and see from what piece it comes and who wrote it. And as I do on all the concerts I conduct, I'll be telling a little bit about the music as we go, just sort of to give it some context and tell the audience, you know, why we programmed these pieces together and what will be coming up next on the program. So, yeah, I think it's a great opportunity to, of course, learn a little bit about the music, but, of course, to have just an enjoyable, wonderful night sitting out under the stars listening to some of the greatest music ever written.
You'll be here on May 31st in New Bern, but also want to remind our listeners that this same program will be coming to Tarboro on June the 4th and Jacksonville June the 7th. So you'll be performing basically the same program, just in case people seem to miss it here on the 31st here in New Bern.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it'll be the same program all three times, and it's, you know, great opportunity all 3 days to hear it.
I understand you've got some other summer concerts that you're going to be performing around the state and eastern North Carolina in particular, too, as well.
Yeah, do a 4th of July concert that we do in a number of different locations.
All right. Well, David, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Down East Journal, and hope you have an enjoyable weekend here in New Bern.
I'm sure we will. Thanks a lot.
In eastern North Carolina, we can be inundated with wildlife. That inundation also frequently works itself into language. Commentator Joan Karras muses on the intersection of wordplay and wildlife.
As you know, every language has its own set of figures of speech, cliches, and colloquialisms, those quirky verbal bits that occur in all languages. They are called tropes by the literati. As a word, trope is muscling its way into popularity. I expect it to replace all those other words in the way that venue has supplanted the words site and place. Venue sounds classier, I suppose. English has a vast number of tropes, many linked to the animal world. We might say, for instance, that Trudy is a goose. That's a simile, of course, though it could also be a mathematical equation. Trudy equals goose. Now, are all geese silly, flighty, not too bright? Pretty much. Being called a goose is no compliment. And then there are rabbits, bunnies. We have a mama rabbit who nests every year in the hawthorn bushes outside our kitchen window. Scientists say that the rabbit is exhibiting site fidelity, returning to the same place every year for the same purpose. Our big cat, Bob, understands scientific lingo, and so every year he pillages the nest several times. We shake our heads and say, "Dumb bunny," knowing that there will be enough babies left over for us to qualify as a rabbit preserve. The animal that's done the hardest work for humankind for over 6,000 years is the ox, or bullock, as he's called in some countries. Oxen, symbols of strength and fortitude down through the ages, are castrated male cows, much stronger and steadier than horses. But brainy? Well, no. And so we say, strong as an ox, which is true. If you want to compliment someone's brain in animal terms, you should compare him or her to chimpanzees, number one. Pigs, number two. Bottlenose dolphins, parrots, and whales. The top five, according to many scientists. This ranking considers an animal's brain in terms of its success in its environment, its overall adaptability, and its ability to solve new problems. As the smartest of all domesticated animals, the pig is nearly always underestimated. But once you learn the facts about pigs, you never forget them. Pigs love being clean, and given a chance, would shower many times a day. Pigs enjoy solving new problems or puzzles. In Europe, trained watch pigs patrol their territories with vigilance, whereas many dogs fall asleep on the job. So here, the old tropes fail us completely. We should be saying, "Ooh, smart as a pig," instead of "smart as a whip." A whip knows nothing, for heaven's sake. These beloved old tropes actually work only part of the time, sometimes not at all, as in the case of pigs and jaybirds. One old cliché describes someone wearing no clothes as being naked as a jaybird. Ah, have you ever seen a naked jaybird? Also, although you probably know this, geese, rabbits, and oxen do not appear in the list of the top 25 smartest critters on the planet.
The Broadway production and the winner of the 2013 Drama Desk Award for Outstanding Play, Vanya and Sonya and Masha and Spike, comes to New Bern. Michael Peterson speaks with the Rivertown Players director, Lori Favre, about the production that opens June 5th and runs through June 14th.
The plot of the play is about Vanya and his sister Sonya, who are living a quiet life in Pennsylvania where they grew up, and their movie star sister Masha returns for an unexpected visit with her boy toy Spike. When I saw the play off-Broadway in New York, my favorite part, of course, was when Masha first comes to town and she has Spike with her. I know you couldn't choose your favorite scene. Why do you think that is?
Because every scene offers up so much feeling, whether it's laughter, which is throughout every corner you turn, but also the poignancy of the relationships between all of the characters and what they bring to the table.
Last year, you directed Agatha Christie's And Then There Was None. How did you get attached to direct this piece?
I read the script, the first couple of pages, and knew right away that this was something I was interested in. And by the time I had finished the script in a very short window of time, I knew I just really had to do it. It spoke to me on so many levels. The flaws and vulnerabilities of these characters are so great and so relatable to practically anyone and everyone.
This production has six people, which is a pretty small cast. To choose parts, I understand you use colorblind casting. What types of qualities were you looking for?
Well, somebody who can embody a particular character, whether I initially see it or not. And that's, you know, obviously what the audition process is about. For a show of a cast this small and where the relationships are so crucially important, the chemistry has to be spot on. And I couldn't say more about the cast that has been put together.
What has been the most difficult part of doing this play?
Well, getting everyone to keep a straight face and long enough to get through a rehearsal. Keeping people in character so that they're not cracking each other up. That's been a little difficult. Of course, that's not a bad thing.
No, that's not a bad thing at all. When I saw this play, what I took away from it was the importance of family and roots and the virtue of remaining hopeful. What do you hope the audience takes away from it?
I'm essentially the same thing. I hope they take away the underlying reasons for what's happening on stage, that the funniness comes from a little deeper within.
Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike and Cassandra and Nina will be opening on June 5th.
And it is an adult show. So, you know, there's the fun of doing that, of putting something on the stage that's a little irreverent. Okay, a lot irreverent. And just make people laugh and come out and enjoy it.
Lori, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it so much, Michael.
For more information on the Rivertown Players' performance of Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike, go to our website, publicradioeast.org, and click on ENC Events.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. The last several weeks of warm weather have sent my summer crops into a happy growing frenzy. My tomatoes are getting rangier and more boisterous by the day. Tomatoes can be a challenging crop to grow in our warm, humid summers, but they're definitely worth the effort, especially when I can nibble my own cherry tomatoes right there in the garden. I grow 5 or 6 varieties of tomatoes each year. One reason is just plain fun. There's always a new variety or interesting heirloom that I want to try. The other reason is that growing different varieties of tomatoes hedges my bets. Different varieties have different disease susceptibilities and may perform differently depending on the season. So in a challenging year, one variety may do well while others flounder. Speaking of the varieties that do well, smaller fruited varieties like cherry tomatoes, pears, and Romas are generally easier to grow than the larger fruited beefsteak varieties. I take this into consideration, and you should too, especially if you're just getting started. One of my favorite varieties is Super Sweet 100. This is a cherry variety with small, intensely flavorful fruit, and it grows like a weed. This doesn't mean that we can't grow decent-sized tomatoes. Look for varieties that produce medium-sized fruit, like Celebrity or Better Boy. They consistently perform well here. You just want to leave the big beefsteak varieties for areas with cooler nighttime temperatures than we have. One of the big tomato debates is caging versus staking. I like to cage my tomatoes, simply because it's easier. I set the cage at the time of planting, and I don't have to put as much time and effort into training as I would have to do if I was staking them. There is a cost. Aim for a tomato cage that's at least 4 feet high once it's set in the ground. 5 is even better for indeterminate varieties. Check each week and tuck straggling shoots back inside the cage. A lot of times, I will reinforce a tomato cage with a sturdy stake to help support the cage throughout the summer when the plant gets larger and heavier. If you are caging your tomatoes, suckering really isn't necessary. Suckers are the side shoots that develop between the main stem and the leaf. A lot of people remove suckers to help if they're staking the tomatoes. If you're staking, removing the suckers keeps the plant narrower and more manageable. Suckering helps promote early yield, but you'll actually harvest more fruit over a longer window of time if you don't sucker your plants. I seem to have a lot of suckers this year, and I've removed some of them just to keep the plants more manageable. I like to root removed suckers to make additional plants. This is really easy to do. Choose a sucker that is 6 to 8 inches long, cut it off, and place it in a glass of water. I put mine in the kitchen windowsill. Tomato suckers will set new roots within a week or two. When my sucker has a nice set of roots, I'll pot it up in a 1 gallon pot using new clean potting soil and place it in a shaded, sheltered location outside. I like to keep my pots evenly moist until the new cuttings are well established. After a couple of days, I can gradually move the pot into full sun, and in 2 or 3 weeks, the plant will have rooted out through the container and can be planted out in the garden. These later plantings help extend the harvest. Tomatoes often take a break for us in the middle of summer. Pollination does not occur when nighttime temperatures get too hot, but with a little patience and ingenuity, you can extend your harvest until the first frost of fall.